First, I want to thank the committee for, you know, I always should do this at the end because I'm more thankful at the end than I am in the beginning for inviting me. It's been quite an adventure getting here. I called Marvella about a month or so ago and said, "Don't worry about me, I'll get there." And she said, "Fine." So I started trying to call her to tell her when I was going to get here, and there was no answer. So I thought, well, what if they've canceled me? Because I didn't know anybody else. But I said I'd show up, and so I finally got in touch with her, and she told me she'd been in the hospital, but that somebody would pick me up. I said, "Marvella, I have two big suitcases. I've been gone from home for a while, and I don't have any other way to do this." She said, "Oh, that's okay. Everything will be okay." So I got off the plane, and I'm looking for someone, and I see Mary peeking over the banister, and she said, and I knew it was her, and so we talked, and we was walking toward the baggage, and I said, "By the way, I have some luggage," and she said, "Yes, I know." So we got to the luggage, and I have these huge, big suitcases, and she said, "You really do have big suitcases." I was too embarrassed to bring all of the bags into the hotel, so I just have one bag in the hotel. But we got here, and I'm grateful. Well, all of my life, I've always been in a hurry to get through doing whatever I was doing so I could do something else, because it was going to be better. I never liked what I was doing. You know, I just knew that there was something missing, and just as soon as I got through doing this, well, then it was going to be okay, and I was going to be happy. Now, I want to tell you something, folks. I started this before I started to school, and I started to school when I was 5 years old. I just knew that my life would be different. Now, how I knew that, I don't know. I don't remember, quote, being that unhappy as a child. I just was discontented. You know, I wanted something different than what I had. I started to school, was happy for a little while, and then I began to see the big kids, and they were doing things that I wanted to do, and I wanted to be with them, so it was going to be better when I got there. When I got there, it was going to be better when I got in high school, and it was going to be better when I got out of high school. And that's the way, you know, I remember that. It was just always going to be better after a while. Tomorrow, it was going to be better. I lived in a let's pretend world. You know, I remember racing home from high school to listen to a program called Let's Pretend on the radio. Now, I know I don't look that old. That was before television, but I did listen. And I believed all of the things that they said in these fairy tales. And they said they got married and lived happily ever after. That was my next go. It was going to be better when I did that. Now, I'm only 16 years old, and this is during World War II. And I decide that I'm going to marry this cute little sailor that lives down the street, and that's home on leave, and I did. And he went away to war, and this was before we knew all these great things to keep from having babies, and I, of course, immediately got pregnant because it was going to be better when I did that. And I'm in nursing school, and I have a child. And I remember they brought that baby to me, and I'm not quite 17 years old. I'm just lacking about 2 or 3 weeks being 17. And they handed me this child, and he looked like a little old man, you know. And I remember looking at him, and I think, I'm holding him, and I think, what in the hell am I supposed to do with you? You know, what am I supposed to do? Now, my confidence was already beginning to waver a little bit with myself, because people were saying things like, "Oh, she's so young. You know, poor little thing. What is she going to do with this child?" Now, I've almost finished nursing school, and I'm out of high school, and I almost finished nursing school. You know, but I'm so young, you know, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And my parents are saying things like, you better take good care of that baby because they will take them away from you. Well, I don't know who they are, but I didn't want them to take that baby. So I'm going to be this wonderful mother, but I don't know what to do with him when I get him and I look at him. And I remember that I'm sitting there holding him, and I think, it'll be better. I remember telling him this. It'll be better when you can walk, when you can talk, when you go to school, when you get out of school, when you're in college. Because I didn't know my reality of things, of having to deal with that. I found no joy in that. It was just that I had to do it perfect. Well, his father came home, and we got an apartment, and we found out something real fast. We didn't even like each other, much less love each other. But in my family, you can shoot somebody, you can go to the nut house, you can do most anything, but you don't get a divorce. And especially when you marry and run off and get married like I did, because you made your bed and you're going to lie in it. You know, no matter what, you got yours to bear and you're going to do this. So when everything's wonderful and things are going so great along those lines, what do? You have another baby. And that's what we did. Another little boy. And he had only worked in a grocery store or something, so he had to go back to college, and I'm working, and he goes to school, and we scream and yell and carry on like, somebody said, white trash. And I guess that's what we did, because we didn't know how to do anything different. And along about this time, somebody said to me, you know, Elvis, what's wrong with you? You need to go to church and get saved and let God run your life. So I said, oh, okay. So there's a little new Baptist church, you know, and so they come to visit. So I went to church and I got saved and I started telling God what to do. Now, I need to tell you how I went to church. The weekends was always the worst time. I hated the weekends because, you see, during the week, I could go to the hospital and work. And I became a workaholic a long time before I knew what that word even meant, because I didn't have to go home, see. But on the weekends, I had to be at home. And I didn't know how to cope. And so I would do this let's pretend deal, you know. Let's pretend that I live in this beautiful house with a white picket fence. My husband adores me. My children are perfect. And everything is just wonderful. And I could build in that dream, and I would just, you know, my mind would go wild in it. And I would do okay. You know, I had to go to get my hair done, and I had to get the clothes all fixed, and I had to go to the grocery store, and especially to get everything ready to go to church on Sunday. Because the church I went to, you only went there to see what I was wearing, or the children was wearing, or, you know, I had to make this big impression. If one of the children came in and said, Mommy, I just started screaming. You know, I just would scream for no apparent, and I'd think to myself, what's wrong with you? You know, why are you screaming? But they brought me out of my dream. And if he came in, I really did go crazy. I mean, I just couldn't hardly stand it. And then on Sunday morning, I'd get up, come down the hall, jerk the kids out of the beds, cram breakfast down their throat, you know, get the boys dressed, and my little girl, we had another baby, little girl. And she had long blonde hair, and, you know, and I had to put her on these thousands of petticoats, you know, and brush that hair, and she's screaming and yelling and saying I'm pulling and I'm hurting and she's itching and I'm hitting her in the head with the brush. You know, getting her all dressed, and I remember cramming her little hands down in those white gloves and taking her in and sitting her on the couch with the boys and saying, "Now, by God, sit down and be still and don't get messed up. We're going to church." You know, and then he'd get up. Now, I want to tell you something. We could have our best fights on Sunday morning. We could say the most vile things to each other. We could say the most horrible curse words that you've ever heard. I don't even know where they come from. You know, I think we saved up till Sunday morning, and we're yelling, screaming, cussing, fussing with each other, and the kids are waiting to go to Sunday school. We get in the car, we go to church, you know, screaming, yelling, cussing all the way. We went to this big church, you know, with the steeple and everything. We'd park and get out, hold the baby's hand, walk up, you know. I taught Sunday school. All good Al-Anons teach Sunday school. That's what's the matter with our kids today, folks. When your life is in hell, you know, you teach about how much Jesus loves you. I sing in the choir, we'd leave church, shake hands with the preacher, get in the car, and take up right where we left off. And the kids are saying, "Mommy, Daddy, don't do that. You know, let's don't do that. You know, don't do that." Never one time, I promise, never once did I think that I was hurting my children. I never, you know what, I didn't think about my children at all. I don't know what I thought about my children. It never dawned on me the effect that that type of behavior would have. I was totally insane. And that, you know, and I just passed that right on down like it was this plate of cookies or fruit or something. Just passed it right on. Well, we did that for 23 years. And I got sick and tired. God never did anything I told him to, and he certainly didn't do anything I told him to. And I said, "That's it." Now, I didn't want a divorce, because I didn't want to be a divorcee. And so I said, we got a legal separation. We don't have those anymore, but that's what we had, and which doesn't really mean a whole lot. And I went into a different field in the hospital. The boys, my youngest son was a senior in high school, and my other son was a senior in college. And my daughter was beginning to start, there's 6 years difference between the last two, and she was going into junior high, and I give up. I just give up. I didn't want anything else to do with that. And I hated God, and I hated man in that order. And I went into a different field in the hospital and became a department head, went back to school, and really got into my work. I want to say this. I was not always that unhappy with my children growing up. I loved my children a lot. And we had some good times. You know, we had some good times, especially the children and I. And I'm grateful for that today. And I just want to kind of throw that in. But I went into a different field, and I began to work, and my daughter, you know, and I was happy with her, and we had a lot of fun together, she and I did, and we did things together. When she was a senior in high school, I still went into a little different field in the hospital, and this is what was going on with me when Jim came into my life. Now, Jim was different than most of the men that I knew. He was kind and attentive, and he listened to me talk, and he was very helpful in the business that I was in. And besides that, he has the most gorgeous blue eyes that you've ever seen in your life. And I was impressed. But Jim never really said anything personal about himself or what was going on with him, and I never did with him. On Christmas Eve of 1967, He brought me a very romantic Christmas present, a little crock of cheese. And he said, as he was leaving my office, he said, "You know, I think I've fallen in love with you." Now, the most romantic thing that Jim had ever said to me was, "Let's have coffee in the cafeteria." Hospital cafeterias are not romantic. You know that. But he turned around and walked out of my office and out of the hospital and left. He called on me every 3 weeks. He'd come back in 3 weeks and he said, "Hi." Never mentioned, never looked like he had ever said anything. Now I'm looking all this time. In April of that year, I said to him, "Jim, how come you told me that? How come you said that you had fallen in love with me?" He said, "You know, for the first time in my life, I do believe that I love another human being." He said, "I want to tell you something. I'm not divorced. My divorce is not final. I'm an alcoholic, and I go to Alcoholics Anonymous 7 days a week and twice on Sunday. And all I have to offer you is an affair. And my sponsor won't let me have one of those damn things." Well, I don't exactly know what I'm going to do here, because I used to switch this over to Jim, but most of you have heard Jim, and you know his story. We did go to see his sponsor. We did talk to him, and that was very strange. That was a really, really different experience for me. We did go, and he told Jim, you know, to let me alone, and that I needed to go to Al-Anon, and that I needed to see, because, see, Jim had made a commitment that, you know, he told me, he said, "Elvis, if I don't have this program, I don't have a life, and I don't have anything to offer you. You know, this is my way of life, because I have to have it. You know, and maybe you need to go and choose and see what you want." Well, I went, you know, I mean, after the sponsor, I'm kind of getting mixed up here because this is usually Jim's story. But Jim told me how to go to Al-Anon. He said, "You go to Al-Anon and you go in there and you tell them your name is Eloise and that you're going to marry an alcoholic and don't tell them another damn thing." So I went to Al-Anon and I told them my name was Eloise and I didn't tell them another, and I was going to marry an alcoholic and didn't tell them another damn thing. We had 5 meetings on why I should not marry the alcoholic. I didn't tell him it was sober, for one thing, and another thing, I didn't tell him it was Jim Williams. But anyway, we finally went across town. Went back and I said, "Hey, Jim, this is not working. You know, something's going on." And so we went to across town, and we went to an open AA meeting. And the very first meeting that I attended of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was this lovely lady up behind the podium, just like I am, and she was talking about feelings. Now, she talked about resentments. You see, this is the language of the heart, and only those of us that know this language can understand. So I know I'm supposed to be here. But she talked about resentments. She talked about reliving things over and over again, that they made her feel physically ill. My God, I have lived that way all of my life. To play that scene over and over again till it makes my stomach hurt. You know, she talked about fear, a feeling of impending doom. I knew if I ever stopped, this huge black thing, whatever it was going to get me, and I'd never escape. She talked about all of the things that we talk about here. On the way home, I said, "Jim, do you have to drink to be an alcoholic? He said, yeah, I think that's one of the requirements. But for the first time in my life, I identified with another human being on the things that they were saying. Now, this is my opinion, okay, and I have the right to have an opinion. I think that when the alcoholic loses the desire, when God takes the desire for booze or pills or the chemical or whatever it is, I think we're more alike than we are different. I think we have a living problem. Jim and I got married, and I was wonderfully happy for a few months. And then I realized something. I knew that everything that had ever been wrong with me in my entire life, I had crammed in these huge trunks and brought them right into this new marriage. I still had a let's pretend idea. You see, I knew that if another person really loved me and cared about me, I'd be okay. Do you know what love is? Love is a good and precious gift from God. And I knew that another human being felt that way about me. But I also knew that if I didn't get rid of the things that was wrong with me, it wasn't going to work. Right after this, I was sitting on the bed one morning talking on the telephone, and I heard Jim in the bathroom, and I thought he called me, and I excused myself and went to the bathroom and pushed the door open, and Jim's on his knees praying. And he said, God, I feel like a son of a bitch this morning. Well, I'm going to tell you something. Good Southern Baptists don't talk to God that way. I went back and I told my friend, do you know what Jim told God? She said, no. And I told her, and she said, ooh, I wouldn't tell God that. She said, you know, that's kind of honest. Jim came out of the bathroom, and he's getting dressed, and he's dancing around, and he's happy. And I'm looking at him, and I said, Jim, how come you told God you felt like a son of a bitch? And he said, they tell me I have to tell God everything. Because, you see, no human power can change that. Only God can change that. I heard that, folks. I heard that. I started going to a group, a two-hour group, on Wednesday morning in Houston, Texas. The first hour is discussion, and the second hour is the steps. The very first night, the very first morning I was there, this lady came in, and she was totally devastated by the disease of alcoholism. I don't know, I think her husband was in jail, and her kids are crazy, and, you know, all the things that are wrong in an alcoholic marriage. And a judge had sent her there. And he says, she kept saying, help me. I have to do something. Tell me something to do. I have to do something. And she's crying, and there's about 25 or 30 women there. And she just keeps repeating this over and over again. And all of a sudden, I felt this magic that we call love. The love of God began to encircle that room. And nothing was said. She was the only one. But all of a sudden, she got quiet. And then I heard something. He said, you can let go and let God. Now, I'd been hearing that, but I'm thinking, let go and let God do what? Because I'd been attending meetings all the time. And then I heard somebody else say, You can let go and let God do for you what you cannot do for yourself. And boom, all of a sudden, the light began to come on. And I began to hear things. You know, in our preamble, we say, take what you can use and store the rest. You may need it in the future. I'm going to tell you something, folks. I had a lot of stuff stored up there because I don't believe that you can come to this program. By the way, since I have been in this program since October of 1969, I attend at least 3 Al-Anon meetings a week, plus about 2 open AA meetings a week. Al-Anon is a person that goes to Al-Anon and practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've done that from the very beginning. And that doesn't include these talks that we go around and give. That means going to the Al-Anon program. And I had stored a lot. Because, see, I think you can just come in here and sit and things begin to happen. You know, you begin to put. And all of a sudden, these things that I heard begin to take hold of me. And I begin to see. And I begin to understand. For the first time in my life, I begin to understand something of God. The second hour of that meeting was on the steps. And we were on the first three steps. And it said that we're powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable. I'm going to tell you something, folks. I'm powerless over alcohol, but I'm powerless over me. I'm powerless over the things that I think, over the things that I do, over my reaction to things. I'm powerless over that. When I don't know how to do different, I'm a dangerous person to be around. You know, because I can destroy myself and everything around me. I'm powerless. I'm the one that makes my life unmanageable. Not people, places, and things. I'm the one that does. It's me. It's an inside job. And when I'm separated from God, I don't do well. The second step says that we need to be that we can be restored to sanity. I never had sanity. Sanity to me is sane thinking. I never had sane thinking. Never. You know why I kept coming back to Al-Anon? You know one of the reasons that Al-Anon was real important to me? I'm going to fall over. I heard a girl talk about trying to murder her husband. She went about it in a dumb way, but I listened to that. You know, she boiled oleander leaves, and he come home drunk, and she told him it was coffee, and she kept pouring this. Oh, it was awful. And everybody was roaring. It wasn't really funny to me, because, you see, I spent years thinking about what would happen if he got killed. I wouldn't have wanted him to get killed because I had more money, you know. I thought about, you know, just dying of a heart. I didn't care. You know, I spent, you know, and I would even think about what I was going to wear to the funeral, about what I was going to take, you know, what the kids was going to wear, you know, because I didn't think I could ever get out of that marriage. You know, I didn't think there was any way that I could get rid of that thing, of him. I just didn't think that. Now, I'm carrying all this around, and once again, a good Southern Baptist don't think that way. But I did, see? And when I heard her tell that, I thought, God, how can you tell that in this, you know, meeting and say that? But I kept watching her, and she was happy, you know, and she was happy. And I, you know, and so I kept coming back, and I remember I'd just sit and look at her because she would tell that. And so I needed sanity. After I got through, and I got tired and sick and tired of thinking about him dying, I got to thinking about me dying. And I had over 25 years of nursing at that time. And I was thinking more about me dying than I was being of service to other people. And I carried that around with me too. And so it said, you know, I needed to be restored to sanity. Now, I'm sure some things that I was going to help this little thing along with my husband dying. One time I threw a knife at him, and it went right by the side of his head. Now, I had a good excuse for doing it. That's not true. And it stuck in the wall. And it dawned on me, my God, what are you doing? What are you doing? One time I threw a hammer and it went out the plate glass window and hit the man next door. So I was not sane, folks. I was not sane. I don't mean to laugh. I hit my husband. He always loved to work on cars, and I hit him one time under the hood of the car, and the hood came down and hit his head, and took him to the hospital, where I'm a department head, into the emergency room. They said, "What happened? She hit me." And they laughed. I remember the first time I told that, it was not funny. I was in tears. But they laughed like you did, and the healing started in me. The healing. When we can laugh at the insanity in our own lives, we can do that. By the way, Jim didn't know about all these kind of things. So I knew that I needed sanity. By the way, I have to say something, and I hope I don't offend any Al-Anons that are here. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I love Al-Anon. Alcoholics Anonymous has been as much in my recovery as Al-Anon. But my recovery is in Al-Anon. I love the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I read the big book for me. It was written for me. And I can identify with the insanity that is there. It doesn't have to be alcohol. It just has to be insane thinking and doing. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we take the third step with another person. And I had a lady that I had called my sponsor at that time, and I called her over, and she came over, and I told her I wanted to take the third step. She said, "Fine, but let me ask you some things about God." I said, "Fine." She said, "Tell me about what you think God is." So listen, I can tell you what I think about God. And I proceeded to tell her. Finally she stopped and she said, "Elvis, if you know so damn much about God, how come your life's so damn screwed up?" And I couldn't answer. And she said, "I want to tell you something. Most of the things that you tell me about God," because she said, "I'm a good Southern Baptist too, is what man says. You cannot take the Bible and show me all these things that you tell me that you think you know about God. They're not in there. It's what somebody has said behind here. And you have a very small God." And I knew that was true. Because, see, nobody had ever really confronted me. "You tell me what you think about God. Not what somebody else says, but what you think." We got on my knees, and I turned my life and my will over to God as I understood Him that day. She left, and I began to cry. And I walked the floor, and I cried, and I cried. That was the first time in about 10 years or maybe 15 years that I had cried. I remember the day that I said, "I will never cry again. I will never cry again." When we turn off a gift that God gives us, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. Because that gives me the ability to stuff and to deny and to do things to me. and I cried. I have a very good friend that's a psychiatrist. I called him. I said, I think I'm losing my mind. He knew me well, and he said, no, honey, those are the tears that you should have shed years ago. I finally went in my bedroom, and I knelt down by the bed, and I said, God, I feel like a son of a bitch. Now, I don't know really what that word is, what it really entails. I just know that it's a word people say when there's nothing left to say, you know. And for me, it was disappointment. It was anger. It was hurt. It was all the things that I had been stuffing for so many, many years. I wish that I could tell you that I got up and everything was wonderful and I never had another bad day. But as you know, that's only when we get started. But for the first time in my life, I could get started on me. I could look at me and my reactions and the things that I was doing to me and find out what I wanted out of my life. By the way, when my sponsor left that day, she said, Eloise, I want you to read the chapter to the agnostic and call me and tell me what it said. So I read the chapter to the agnostic, and I called her, and I told her what it said. She said, you missed it. Read it again. So I read it again, and I called her. She said, you missed it. Read it again. So I picked it up once again, and I started reading. She called me back, and she said, read very slowly. I called her back, and I said, God is either everything or he's nothing. She said, you got it. You got it. He's either everything or he's nothing. And that's true today. That's true today in my life. He's either everything or he's nothing. And I don't know about you, but for me, I found a loving God. I found out what he says about what things that he will do, things that he won't do. I have to go through the rock crusher a lot. And I want to tell you something. I want to talk about my kids, and I want to talk about Jim, and I want to talk about the way that things are today. And you know, I don't want to do this because, you see, things are not real good in my life today. I like to come to you and tell you about things when everything is wonderful and things are going great. But you invited me here, and when I was praying today, I said, God, you know, what am I going to do? Am I just going through the same routine that I usually go through? Or am I going to tell you what's going on in my life today? I don't really want to do that. But you know what he said back to me? Now, God doesn't speak to me in a voice. It's that quiet, sweet voice that's within me. He said, I knew you were going to be here when Marvella called. And I knew the things that were going on. So here it comes, folks. I talk about my children. My oldest son was the one that was hurt the worst with my insanity that I lived with my former husband with. He was hurt the most. He had the most resentments, and took him the longest for God to heal. And he's a Southern Baptist preacher. But I'm grateful today that because I attend an Al-Anon meeting on Tuesday morning with about 50 or 60 women, and we believe in prayer, real prayer, God answering prayer. I was going to visit him, and I said, I need for you to pray for me. Now, James and I had great expectations of each other, and you know what it says about expectations. And we loved each other dearly, but we didn't like each other. We couldn't really enjoy being with each other. But that morning that I was going to leave that night, we held hands and somebody prayed. And you know what they said? God, help Eloise to be exactly what you want her to be. and to set James free. I was not in the house 30 minutes till he came and he knelt down beside of me and he said, "Mama, now my children are grown children and they call me mother." Mother means you have a very important place in my life, but mind your own business. Mama means I'll let you do for me. You know, I love being mama. And he hadn't called me mama in a long time. And he said, "Mama, I want that thing healed between us. I want us to love each other and to be free." And I said, "I do too." And for that, I'm grateful. He has a beautiful wife that calls me her best friend. That's a gift from God, folks. That's a gift from God. I'm not a mother-in-law. I'm a good friend, and I'm grateful. They have my beautiful granddaughter, my first granddaughter. I'd love to tell you about her, but I'm afraid you'd think I was just a prejudiced grandmother. But she's lovely, and she brings me lots of joy. My second son, I know, has a drinking problem. I used to say, "I think." I know. You don't think I want to fix that, do you? He tells me that he watches it and that he controls it and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I say, okay. But the program has taught me to learn to love for free and to set him free and for him to be what God wants him to be. He's an executive with Shell Oil Company. And I really got upset, and I hate to tell you this, but I thought he was going to lose his job, and I was really wanting to get him, so forget it. I let go of that. He has my one and only grandson that I think is wonderful. He's everything I ever wanted in a grandson and more too. He also has a lovely little girl. And I'm very proud and very grateful for them. My daughter taught me what Al-Anon was about. She met this old long-haired, pot-smoking, yucky old boy in college. And he liberated her, whatever the hell that means. But Charlie and Chrissy didn't do well together. They would get into this big fight, and Chrissy got a lot of furniture in the divorce, and so she had all this furniture, and her and Charlie were living together, and they'd get in, and she'd call me, and Jim and I would go get a trailer, and we'd go get all that old furniture, and we'd go take it to the storehouse, and we'd bring that little darling home, and before I could get dinner ready, her and Charlie were back together again. Now, they did that. I mean, you know, they did that about four or five times. And finally, the last time, you know, I was in the tub. And, oh, God, she'd come home and she was horrible. Oh, and she was sullen and she was yucky. And I just, you know, I was in the bathtub one night and I said, God, I am so tired of that kid, I could die. Now, she's not a kid. She's 22 years old. 20. And once again, that voice in my head said, "If you let go, I'll take her." I had to back up a little bit. My sponsor, I had been crying to her about it, and she said to me, "You know, Elwes, I didn't know Chrissy was mentally retarded." And I said, "Well, she's not." And he said, "You treat her that way." Out of her, and God says, "If you'll let go, I'll take her." Now, I remember that I got out of that tub and I put a towel or a robe or something on it. I went in that living room and I got down and I walked in there to her and I said, "I'm going to tell you something, little girl. I want you to live with Charlie. I want you to live without Charlie. I want you to go to school. I want you to quit school. I don't care what you do because I'm setting you free." Now, they tell us in Al-Anon to let go with love. I just let go.
because I couldn't let go any other way. That's the best I could do. I remember she looked at me, and she's got these big old eyes, and, you know, and I just had to turn around and walk off. Well, Jim gave her back some credit cards and went and helped her get her apartment, and she got a job, and we went through a healing thing with that, and it wasn't long till Chrissy came over and said, Mother, I want to bring Charlie over tonight. And I said, okay. And Charlie came over, and he said, and he'd shaved that beard and cut his hair. And he said, I know you don't like me, but he said, I really do love Chrissy, and we want to get married. And I said, Charlie, I think you and Chrissy deserve each other. Well, Charlie and Chrissy got married. They were married almost 12 years. Out of that came two beautiful little girls that have brought more pleasure to Jim and I. See, Jim and I think we would just be these wonderful parents because we'd have the little kids, you know, and they would just be perfect if they're raised in this program. You know that? And they just, you know, we would just do all these kind of things. And we have pretended, let's pretend with those little girls that they were ours. And the oldest little girl absolutely worships her grandfather. And the little girl, the youngest one did me, but I think she's going to desert and go over to him too. But anyway, you know, they come and spend time with us. And we wake up a morning, you know somebody's looking at you. And you open and they're standing there, you know. And, oh, we just have such a good time with them. But Chris and Charlie live in a real world. Chrissy left Charlie about 6 months ago on Sunday, and he went into the program on Monday. For a while, I thought, oh, boy, I'm going to put the plug in the jug and never have another bad day. But that hasn't happened. That hadn't happened. You know, you can live. Now, Charlie hasn't drank. The oldest little girl is 7, and he hasn't drank since she was born. But they've been living in untreated alcoholism. And I know what it means to live with a person on a dry drunk. And Charlie's been on a dry drunk, and I'm not taking his inventory. We just know that. That's what's happened, because that's what he says. I don't know what's going to happen. That almost killed me, you know, because once again, I wanted to fix her. I'm an erotic fixer. And God, when I get you fixed, please stay fixed. Don't come unraveled. You know, just stay fixed. My mother had another bout with cancer. I lost my mother in the last January. It was a real experience because my mother was the first to die. I had lost grandparents, but I have never lost anyone that close before. And it was a real experience. My mother was 80 years old, but my mother was not an old lady. My mother was a very young lady. And she died a horrible death on life support. And I don't know what I think about that, but I'm like somebody, I'm going to have it, no life support tattooed. Because it's a horrible thing. And it was a real experience. My father went to the doctor while my mother was in the hospital. And he got the results back a week after she died, and he has cancer. Kind of get up that. I don't know if those of you that are hospital people, Jim is in the hospital field. Our finances went to hell. You know, it was like, what's going on? You know, it was just like, you know, you get through one tidal wave, then here it comes back. And Jim and I kind of went crazy with each other, and we didn't know what to do.
Jim and I have never talked mean or found fault with each other. You know. But I was afraid we were going to do that, and he was too. I went to visit a little girl that God has given me, that's like a daughter to me, in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. We talk on the phone, and we don't, you know. And I'm going to say this, and I don't mean it anyway, except I'm just saying it. You know, people think because of the fact that Jim goes all over the country and that he carries the message, and I go all over the country and I carry the message, I think that the people that do that sometimes get put up way up here. And when their lives start coming apart, you know, people don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear that. And yet the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we only have a daily reprieve, one day at a time. We only have one day, and that's today. That's today. And sometimes people don't want to hear that. But I'm going to tell you something. God is walking us through. God is walking us through. And I guess that's the only power that we need too. People love us. I want to tell you something. Our group, the Glass House group in Fort Worth, Texas, there's somebody praying for us every hour of the day. They don't know what the hell to do with us. But they're praying for us. And once again, we're going to trust God. Because God is either everything or He's nothing. God is either everything or He's nothing. And I don't like it. I don't like to walk here. But I'll tell you one thing. It sure makes me hear and understand what you say when you come to me. And even in the midst of all of this, people still call and still say, always, I need your help. And Jim, I need your help. And what's going on? I love Jim Williams with all of my heart. And I know that he loves me. And I'm grateful. I couldn't be grateful for what I'm going through. I just started to say that. But I'm grateful for a loving God that says you don't have to have it made. You don't have to be perfect. You know, you're just like everybody else, and you never get it made. You never get it made. You only have a daily reprieve hinged on your spiritual condition. So what does that tell you, folks? We must have found God somewhere along the line. I talked to Jim yesterday morning, and he sends your love, his love. And he said, people in Wichita love me, and you tell them that I love them. And I'm grateful that I could come, and we talked, and I said, what are you going to say? You know, what are you going to tell? He said, I don't know. So what are you going to tell? I don't know. But then when he told me that you loved him and that you would love me, it took the fear away. It took the fear away of coming and saying to you, you know, we need your prayers. We need you to hold us up. You know, we're walking in rough waters now. And we need you. We need you to carry a message to us. We need a healing. The same healing that we needed when we came in here. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love Al-Anon. And I'm grateful to God that I'm right here, right now. Because you see, nobody out there, if I went out and told, in fact, over at the hotel a while ago, several people walked up and wanted to, I forgot about having that on, where are you going to speak, you know, what are you going to talk on? I wonder what they would have said. Well, I'm going to get up and tell them my life's gone to hell. But see, you didn't, you know, I feel you loving me. I feel you loving me. And for that, I'm grateful. And I thank you once again that I could share. Thank you.